From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Sedge Thompson, and this is Fresh Air. We often hear the stories of men fighting apartheid in South Africa. On this edition of Fresh Air, we hear about the women. Diana Russell has collected 24 profiles in defiance in her new book, Lives of Courage. Also today, artist and writer Russell Chatham describes his perspective of the American West. Rock historian Ed Ward profiles R&B singer Ruth Brown. And book critic John Leonard delves into a couple of new mysteries. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Frank Stacio. Soviet President Mikhail Gorbachev's emergency declaration appears to be having little impact on ethnic fighting in the Republic of Azerbaijan. The BBC's Philip Short reports.
Reports from Azerbaijan, as well as statements by officials here in Moscow, suggest the situation is getting worse rather than better. Several thousand heavily armed nationalists are confronting each other in two areas just north of Nagorno-Karabakh. And in the disputed territory itself, the National Council has issued a statement calling on the population to be ready to repel any invasion. In the Azerbaijan capital, Baku, where 2,000 Armenians have been evacuated, militant Azerbaijanis are reported to have surrounded the airport to prevent more refugees leaving. The Soviet news agency TASS said nationalists in Armenia had seized more than 1,500 guns and 30,000 rounds of ammunition. It's not entirely clear why the Soviet army hasn't moved more forcefully since the declaration of the state of emergency, but one Soviet officer was quoted as saying his men were routinely fired on by Armenians and Azerbaijanis alike.
The BBC's Philip Short in Moscow. More than 7,500 coal miners walked off the job today at five mines in southern Poland in that nation's worst labor unrest since the election of a Solidarity-led government in June. Solidarity leaders at the mines say the strikes are mostly over wages, although workers at some mines are pressing for the removal of allegedly corrupt managers and changes in working conditions. Prime Minister Tadeusz Mazowiecki moved quickly to end the strike, promising to meet Thursday with labor leaders at the mines. Defense Secretary Dick Cheney has postponed a news conference scheduled to announce plans for the use of U.S. military forces in the war on drugs. The decision to delay the announcement follows a controversy over a proposal to place an aircraft carrier battle group off the coast of Colombia. More from NPR's Neil Conan.
Over the past few years, the military has been reluctant to get involved in the war on drugs, but earlier this year, Secretary Cheney instructed each of the services to come up with ways they could help. 2 weeks ago, part of the Navy's proposal was leaked to reporters, a Caribbean task force to interdict the flow of drugs. But the plan was publicly characterized as a blockade and said to be underway with the deployment of the aircraft carrier John F. Kennedy to Colombian waters. And that, in the sensitive post-Panama atmosphere, was too much for Colombian President Virgilio Barco. Today, White House Press Secretary Marlon Fitzwater repeated that there will be no decision to deploy U.S. ships in that area without the full support and cooperation of the Colombian government. Pentagon spokesman Pete Williams said that Secretary Cheney's announcement of new military roles in the drug war will be delayed for a couple of weeks at least, and Williams confirmed that the USS John F. Kennedy is paying a call in Mayport, Florida today. This is Neil Conan reporting.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose more than 23 points to close at 2692.66. Advances were ahead of declines by a small margin. This is NPR News. Senate Minority Leader Bob Dole today proposed cutting American foreign aid to the largest recipients and switching the money to emerging democracies in Eastern Europe and Panama. The Kansas Republican met at the White House today with Chief of Staff John Sununu. At the State Department, spokeswoman Margaret Tutwiler said Dole had discussed the proposal with Secretary of State Baker, adding that the plan is worth looking at. AT&T says it has tracked down the problem that led to the worst ever breakdown in long-distance service. And the company says it will try to make it up to customers inconvenienced by yesterday's disruption. NPR's Renee Montaigne has more.
By day's end, AT&T breathed a collective sigh of relief. Its 80 million long-distance calls had gone through essentially without a hitch, meaning, says spokesman Burke Stinson, that the system is back on track. Engineers have figured out what kept millions of callers yesterday from getting through. Stinson says it was a bug in the company's complex computer software. He says there's no evidence that a virus caused the breakdown.
speculation about some kind of dastardly person involved in this seems to be ruled out.
Yesterday's interruption in service came at a time when AT&T is battling smaller competitors by billing itself as the reliable phone company. Today, the company announced it plans to offer a discount day to all of its customers. In Washington, I'm Renee Montaigne.
A large international bank pleaded guilty today to reduced money laundering charges and agreed to pay $14 million in fines in a global drug case with links to deposed Panamanian dictator Manuel Noriega and Colombian drug lords. Luxembourg-based Bank of Credit and Commerce International avoided trial by reaching the plea bargain agreement with prosecutors and agreeing to provide information on the case, as well as forfeit the money and be placed on probation for 5 years. Stock prices rose 23 points on Wall Street to close at $26.92. I'm Frank Stachow, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Terry Gross is on vacation. I'm Sedge Thompson. Other than Winnie Mandela, there are few South African women who are known outside their country, even though there are many women playing key roles in the fight against apartheid. My guest, Diana Russell, has documented the stories of some of these women in her new book, Lives of Courage, Women for a New South Africa. Russell left South Africa in 1959 when she was 20 to attend college in England. She later came to the United States to do graduate work at Harvard. She now teaches sociology at Mills College in Oakland, California. Russell's brother David is a bishop at the Anglican Church. He also works closely with Bishop Desmond Tutu and was a close associate of Stephen Biko. Russell's father was a member of the South African Parliament for 18 years. Diana Russell has written several books on women that focus on sexual abuse, including The Politics of Rape, Rape in Marriage, Sexual Exploitation, and The Secret Trauma, Incest in the Lives of Girls and Women. Russell returned to her native South Africa for 4 months in 1987 to interview 60 women who've been fighting apartheid there. I asked her what drew her to write about the lives and experiences of women in South Africa.
Because they've been so badly neglected, a lot of people don't realize what an important part they play, understandably because they often are not in leadership positions. But what this book shows, what the story shows, is that women are playing a very important role on a grassroots level and in a sort of mid-leadership level and in the women's groups as well. Doing very, very important work, as well as some in leadership positions. And I just wanted their voices to be heard for a change. I also had another agenda, and that was a hope that by doing this book, it might help the movement to take women more seriously. The struggle against apartheid is such a major focus that it's difficult to focus on sexism as well. And, of course, the men use that as well as an excuse not to. They say, you know, that's a distraction. And a lot of the women also feel that. So I hope that this book would just help to strengthen women's position in some small way as well.
You traveled to South Africa at the time when the South African government was being the most repressive within its country as well as on outsiders. What danger did you feel yourself in when you were conducting these interviews?
Well, the first one was whether I'd be allowed in the country at all. That was a great relief. And even when I got my visa, I was only sure that I would get to the airport because they said that I would then be checked by somebody. Fortunately, that didn't happen. But after I'd been in the country 2 weeks, the security branch, the hated sort of security police, wanted to visit me. And I thought that they must have heard, as well they might, that I was going to do this project. I had written to tell a couple of friends about it, and the mail is examined on a haphazard, arbitrary basis, so you never know when a letter will be looked at or not. So I was, I was really afraid that the project would be stopped. When I went up country from Cape Town, where I started out, when I went, traveled up by car, I was actually advised to call a friend every day back in Cape Town and at a specific time. If I didn't call at that time, then that friend should call my lawyer and my lawyer would go search for me in prison. They thought, because that often happens, if I didn't have anybody to call, it often happens that you're just detained. They don't have to tell anybody that you're detained. There's no statement about where you are. So this is the way people just disappear. So I was told to sort of check the tire, get a tire gauge to check the pressure in my tires, because another common thing that's done is to blow your tires up so that you're likely to, have a traffic accident. I was told not to carry a single note on me, you know, of a woman's name or address, to not have any evidence of what I was doing. And so it went on. I mean, this was rather difficult to do since I was taping the interviews. I was told to duplicate everything, send it out immediately. It was amazing because even though the security branch only tried to see me once, it was as if they were sitting with me all the time. And I never really knew, you know, when should I take a risk, when shouldn't I? In fact, you have to take a risk. Even though this was perfectly legal activity that I was doing, I mean, just interviewing women about what they're doing is perfectly legal. But in South Africa, the security branch can pick you up for whatever reason they want to. And I know somebody who interviewed just one of the women that I spoke to was thrown out of the country for doing so. So I never knew when the project would forcibly end. But miraculously, it didn't.
My guest is writer and scholar Diana Russell. Her new book is Lives of Courage, Women for a New South Africa. You quote Ruth Mompati of the African National Congress as saying, in South Africa, you don't decide to join politics. Politics decides to join you. I'm wondering, since you were born and raised in South Africa, what was the turning point in your life to make you decide to fight apartheid?
Well, I'm sorry to say, I had to leave the country. When I was 20, I left and spent 2 or 3 years in England and then returned. And even though I had become politicized before, I was still so caught up with sexism and feeling that, you know, politics was something that men do and not women do, that it didn't actually occur to me to join a political party. What I did was to hang out with men who joined, you know, the Liberal Party. When I came back, I joined myself and then participated in a nonviolent protest and very quickly came to see or believe that that was hopeless in this kind of a police state. So from that experience, also from reading some books and so on, banned books there, I became a revolutionary and decided to join an underground movement called the African Resistance Movement. When I was asked, you know, would I be willing, I just thought, well, since I don't believe nonviolent methods will work, I must be willing to go this far and join this group that sabotages government property. It was still very much at the first stage of revolution in the sense that it was not trying to do more than be violent in that kind of minimal fashion. Nevertheless, the risk was enormous, and I don't just mean for me, but because I remained a rather peripheral member since I then left the country to come to this country.
This was in 1963. Did you participate in any acts of sabotage yourself?
Well, I was a sort of a backup person in terms of one of the things I had to do was to solicit a surgeon to treat anybody who was hurt in the process of trying to bomb certain things. I had to sort of map out a terrain near a pylon. I had to have my home emptied of my parents and anybody else so that people could come after a bombing to change their clothes and escape. I did things like that. I didn't actually participate in any bombing, literally.
Mm-hmm. A number of the interviews in this book were very powerful and very moving and very painful to read because of what the women who had been in prison went through in terms of torture and the degradation. Could you describe your own sort of sense of these women and their ability to withstand the pain that went on when you were participating in an interview with them?
Well, you know, this is still quite difficult for me to understand because I think a revolutionary situation brings out the best and the worst in different people. And I was interviewing the people that it brought out the best in and the strength. I mean, because I just don't see, I'm sure it exists here, and I know, you know, there's been, you know, a lot of radical movement here. But nevertheless, in the movements I participated in here, I haven't seen that kind of courage. You know, your leg's broken, you are tortured in prison and you want to commit suicide because it's so unbearable, and then you come out and you carry on. And thereby risking being picked up again. I mean, it's just phenomenal. But for me, one of the most powerful interviews was the first one in the book by Elaine Mohammed. I think because she was so articulate about how it felt to be a woman in prison. I mean, obviously all the other women were women in prison, but she was particularly good at portraying the sense of vulnerability she felt with being controlled by these men who she didn't know what they would do. Now, it so happened she was sexually harassed, but she never was actually raped in prison. But her fear of rape, it's a bit like I was describing my fear of the security branch all the time I was there, really, really affected me very deeply, you know, my dreams and nightmares as well, you know. In the same way, you know, her fears she talks about were there with her all the time. Fears, I mean, of course men are afraid of being beaten up and are beaten up, but there's something nevertheless special for women about sexual violation. And she said herself that being just hit was not nearly as threatening to her as the kind of sexual innuendo that she got, like a security branch saying to her how much he liked interviewing women because he was able to get things out of them. And this really terrified her much more than being hit about.
How have these women, or say in particular this woman, coped with her life outside prison after going through this trauma?
Well, that's another thing that comes across very powerfully is the trauma of then getting out of prison and readjusting. I think more than Elaine, a woman called Fasizwe Bukelani, who had been in for 6 years in solitary confinement a great deal, she was accused of terrorism, even though she maintains, and I believe her, that she was trying to help people escape from the country, not actually engaged in anything else. But at any rate, she got 6 years. When she got out, she, you know, everybody expected her to come and make speeches, and she just didn't know what was going on. She found the whole world different. She couldn't make decisions. She couldn't even decide how to spend her money. You know, she just was very, very traumatized, and it took quite a while for her to recover. And the same with Elaine. Elaine feels that, you know, several years later, she still hasn't fully recovered. When she came out of prison, friends came round to visit and so on. One of the things she had done when she was in prison, because it would be very, very hot and she was in solitary confinement for 9 months, only for putting up a communist poster, but it was very hot, so she would take her clothes off and hang them up because nobody could see her. When she came home and there was this gathering, she didn't even realize she was doing it. She took off her pants, hung them over the armchair, and wondered then why people were looking at her. She didn't, you know, she had just dissociated. I mean, she didn't know what she was doing. And she still finds herself, you know, difficult to concentrate and various things. But she's gone on, she's struggled on, and she's, you know, both politically. She started getting involved then in anti-rape work because she was so affected by her fear of rape in prison. So she decided to work on that issue.
I was struck by the lack of support that the women in this book had from the men in their lives, their fathers, the husbands, boyfriends, almost as if the women participated in their political activities on their own with no support in their lives except from other women.
Well, yes, I think that's true. Sometimes of the husbands or lovers or so are in jail, like obviously Walter Sisulu, who's the husband of Albertina Sisulu, who is the co-president of the United Democratic Front, the biggest anti-apartheid organization. So in a sense, he can't be supportive. You know, he's in prison, and that was true for quite a few. But nevertheless, yes, that does come through, I think. Sometimes with the women, there are several stories where their husbands resisted their being politically active and they basically had to get rid of those husbands in order to really be politically active. So you got what comes across as the obstacles, you know, for women to be political. Then, of course, the children are seen as their responsibility. often if their husbands are political, you know, he's off getting, you know, arrested and banned and imprisoned and whatever, which obviously is a big sacrifice. I don't want to belittle that. But then she's left to handle the consequences of her being political as well as dealing with the children and the kind of tearing feeling that gives her. Different women chose to handle that in different ways. You know, Shahada Issel, for example, really kind of educated her children from a very young age so that they were political too. In fact, one of her daughters, well, her only daughter, Layla, spoke at a gathering when she was only seven, and the police were already after her at seven, wanting to get her. She had to go into hiding at that age. Other women have tried protecting their children from their politics and not telling them what they are doing. Nevertheless, if they detained, for many of them, I mean, Winnie Mandela describes the excruciating pain of having her children torn away from her as she's being hauled off to prison with nobody to look after them. That is one of the struggles that I hope to convey, because it's just very different for a woman often trying to be political.
My guest is Diana Russell. She was born in South Africa and has lived in the United States for 26 years. She's a professor of sociology at Mills College in Oakland, California. Her new book is Lives of Courage, Women for a New South Africa. We'll talk more after a short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
I'm speaking with Diana Russell. You were talking earlier about Walter Sisulu. Hasn't he been released from prison?
Yes, he has. Just last year, in 1989, he was released. And so now everybody's waiting for the final one, Nelson Mandela, to be released. And Winnie Mandela made a statement just last week saying that she really believes he's going to be released very soon.
Mm-hmm. One of the women that you interviewed for your book is Winnie Mandela. And in 1989, there were the reports of her involvement in the beatings of some young anti-apartheid, young 14-year-olds with her guards. And you preface your interview by saying that these allegations have come up, and you want to explain it in terms of the pressure that she has been under. And I wonder if you can explain what you saw going on in her life.
Yes, but first of all, I should say, you know, we really don't know fully what did happen, and all the more so since nothing has emerged since then. It's all very mysterious why the white South African government hasn't tried to make something of this. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm,
I mean,
no, the whole story has seemed to have disappeared.
It does. A couple of her bodyguards were prosecuted, and definitely imprisoned. I think they might have been hanged, because of course South Africa is one of the biggest hanging countries in the world, for killing the doctor who testified that one of these young men, Stompie, or boys, I should say, 14-year-olds, a boy, was in very, very bad shape, and he was murdered, and two people among the bodyguards were prosecuted for that, but nothing has happened with Winnie, and it seems like it's all over. So it remains very mysterious. But what I say in the book is, if something like that did happen, we have to understand that people are affected by extreme oppression. I mean, as I said, you know, the revolutions bring out the best and the worst, but, you know, nobody can be expected to remain a saint or even just an ordinary human being necessarily if you are put through a sort of concentration camp experience. I mean, we saw with the concentration camps what happened to some people who actually imitated SS guards and so on, according to Bruno Bettelheim, who was there himself. People break down. Battered women break down when they are, you know, submitted to torture day after day after day, and they become different people. She described how hardened she had become in the interview, that, you know, because I kept trying to get her to talk about her feelings, and even though she does show a lot of feelings, she one of her responses was, well, you know, when you just kind of get one thing after the other, after the other, after the other, I mean, your emotions get blunted. So I don't know what happened, but what I don't appreciate is when people think that it's, you know, so extraordinary if somebody does break down and behave in a terrible way. You know, it's like, and yeah, I found actually a lot of people just refuse to believe anything like that is possible because they have reified her so much. But she is a human being, a remarkable human being. But nevertheless, everybody has their breaking point.
My guest is Diana Russell. Her new book, Lives of Courage, features interviews with women in South Africa. Your brother is a bishop in the Anglican Church of South Africa and was a close associate of Stephen Biko's. He was under house arrest for five years.
5 years is the usual length of time to start with. Often it's then renewed, you know, to another five-year period and so on. And he's also been in prison a few times as well. Not so long ago, he held a commemoration service for the death or murder of Steve Biko, and police came into the church with their guns and tried to stop him. And he sort of stopped the service and refused to give communion as long as there were guns in the church. So in the end, actually, they put them down and took communion.
But that sounds very bizarre.
It does, doesn't it? Well, it does indeed. But actually, South Africans, black and white, are very religious people. And I guess they were affected by, they were told to do this, and they got talked out of it.
You once felt that the whites of South Africa were unconvertible to an anti-apartheid view. They had too much to lose. But you also think that perhaps the behavior of the white regime in South Africa is just the kick of a dying horse. I wonder what your prognosis is.
Well, I think that, you know, people change when they are forced to. And what I couldn't see in the past was how can the white South African government be forced to. I think that a revolution has been necessary. I mean, I mean by that the African National Congress has resorted to armed struggle. And I think that without that threat, I think that nonviolent methods could never have gotten the government to this point. But whether this particular regime will be willing to really, really change and give up their monopoly of power, I very much doubt it. I very much doubt it. Unless the international community, combined with, you know, combined with the internal struggle, kind of force them to be. They could be forced to give it up, definitely. I mean, that's what many women said, too, is like, If the international community wanted South Africa to change now, that could happen.
I want to thank you very much for coming in and speaking with us today on Fresh Air.
It's been a pleasure.
Diana Russell's book, Lives of Courage, Women for a New South Africa, is published by Basic Books. I'm Sej Thompson, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, my guest will be psychiatrist Robert J. Lifton. He's written about the psychology of Nazi doctors, how our minds cope with the possibility of nuclear holocaust, and he's just revised his book on brainwashing. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Sej Thompson with Fresh Air. Coming up, the American West, through the words and images of Russell Chatham. His paintings, lithographs, and writings depict the beauty and isolation of the West's fields, mountains, meadows, and streams. Also, rock historian Ed Ward profiles Ruth Brown. Nowadays, she hosts the NPR program Blue Stage, but in the 50s, she was one of the top R&B singers. And book critic John Leonard reviews A Pair of Mysteries, The Good Fight by Leah Matera, and Devices and Desires by P.D. James. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
For National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. More than 7,500 coal miners walked off the job at five mines in southern Poland today as part of that nation's worst labor unrest since the election of the new Solidarity-led government. Solidarity leaders at the mines said the walkouts were mostly over wages, although workers at some mines were pressing for the removal of managers they consider corrupt, along with changes in working conditions. In Czechoslovakia, President Václav Havel led a service to honor a student who burned himself to death to protest the 1968 invasion of his country. Last year, attending the same service led to Havel's arrest. Nikola Karslaw, the BBC, has more.
The Czech Philharmonic Orchestra played to several thousand in a square in Prague, a place that the people have named Palach Square. The crowds commemorated the young student as the man who gave his life for the freedom and democracy which they finally won by their peaceful revolution. They heard Václav Havel, their president, say he believed that the events which swept aside communism here had their origins in the ultimate sacrifice paid by Jan Palach. A few moments later, Mr. Havel was driven to Wenceslas Square, where, surrounded by students and former dissidents, he laid flowers at the statue of St. Wenceslas, near the place, now a shrine, where Jan Palach set himself on fire. Last year, Mr. Havel and dozens of others were arrested for simply being at the memorial ceremony.
Nikola Karslaw, the BBC, in Prague. In Washington, Senate GOP leader Robert Dole has proposed cutting U.S. foreign aid to the five largest recipients and diverting the dollars to Eastern Europe and other areas. The Bush administration has shown some interest in this proposal. More from NPR's Ted Clark.
If you reduce aid to Israel, Egypt, the Philippines, Turkey, and Pakistan by 5%, you free up $330 million, according to Dole. He argues that it's one of the few practical ways to find money for Eastern Europe, Panama, and other countries in need.
The budget's going to be very tight. There isn't any, aren't any new taxes on the horizon to provide additional funds. There won't be any, quote, big peace dividend that we can put into foreign aid.
One administration official said today the new demands of Panama have frankly thrown us into a crisis. Dole's proposal could help. Dole's plan also takes aim at the widespread congressional practice of earmarking aid funds for projects that Congress deems worthy, reducing the president's flexibility. State Department spokeswoman Margaret Tutwiler expressed interest in Dole's plan today, saying we expect to meet soon with the leadership of the Congress on the matter. This is Ted Clark in Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials closed up over 23 points to close at 2,692.62 on volume of some 186 million shares. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Ruth Brown made rock and roll history in the 50s with a series of hits on Atlantic Records. And she made history again in the 80s when she sued her former label for retroactive royalties and won a decision that benefited both her and dozens of other artists. Rock and roll historian Ed Ward profiles Ruth Brown's early years.
Well, all young men like to have a good time. Well, all young men like to have a good time. Well, all boyfriends like to lose their mind.
It was a standard New York music biz joke in the mid-50s. Uptown, the house that Ruth built was Yankee Stadium, and the Ruth in question was Babe Ruth. Midtown, Atlantic Records was the house that Ruth built, and they were talking about Ruth Brown. Yet today, when people talk about Atlantic's early days, they'll go on at length about the way Ray Charles and Clyde McFadder and the Drifters kept this important independent record label afloat and somehow forget about the woman who spent the early 50s neck and neck with Dinah Washington as America's biggest selling female rhythm and blues artist.
So long. Hope we'll meet again someday. Oh, that maybe then you'll say.
Ruth Brown almost didn't get to record her 1949 hit, So Long. Born in 1928, she'd become a teenage vocalist with the Lucky Millinder Orchestra when a talent scout had heard her sing near her home in Virginia. Millinder threw her out of the band one night in Washington, D.C., but an old high school friend saw her crying on the street as the band's bus pulled away and introduced her to a club owner who hired her on the spot. Soon, her fame had spread to New York, where Atlantic's founders, Herb Abramson and Ahmet Erdogan, decided to give her a contract. On her way to the session in New York, the club owner's car was involved in an accident, and Ruth Brown spent the next year in the hospital.
Along about the evening, I feel so blue. And though my heart is grieving, I'll wait for you. I'm writing you a letter, signed love so true. Although I'm sad and lonely, I'll wait for you.
Once she was out, though, she was unstoppable. Part of this, of course, was due to Atlantic's fanatical devotion to detail. While other labels would slap together a backup group, Atlantic was owned by jazz fans who knew that members of Count Basie's band or Duke Ellington's orchestra were always grateful for paying studio work and really put some effort into their playing. They also encouraged their up-and-coming young star Ray Charles to do arrangements for their established artists, and they wound up with a record that is the one everybody thinks of when they hear the name Ruth Brown.
Mama!
As might be expected from a funky guy like Ray Charles, Mama, He Treats Your Daughter Mean brought out a different side of Ruth's talent, showing that she was a very accomplished blues singer and that she could hold her own over a rocking band. It was also a very big hit and wound up as one of the top 10 R&B records of 1953. By 1955, Atlantic Records really was the house that Ruth built, since nearly every record of hers they put out sold. But they weren't pop hits. And so, eventually, the company began ignoring her. She protested, of course, so they got Jerry Lieber and Mike Stoller, the men who had done so well with the Coasters, to write her a pop hit.
When I was just a little girl with long and silky curls, my mama told me, honey, you've got more than other girls. Now you may not be good looking, but you'll soon wear diamond clips, and you'll never have to worry, 'cause you've got lucky lips. Lucky lips are always kissing. Lucky lips are never blue. Lucky lips will always find a pair of lips that will be true.
That piece of junk actually got to number 25 in 1957 on the pop charts, too. And she showed up there again about a year and a half later with something that Bobby Darin had written for her.
I wrote my mom a letter, and this is what I said. Well, 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 I washed all the dishes and I did a lot more. I even bought the dinner at the grocery store. And now, Mom, you're buying the key next door. This little girl's gonna rock it. I left some biscuits for the pup. I put fresh water in his cup. And now I'm off, I'm gonna live it up. For this little girl's gonna rock it.
By 1962, when she left Atlantic for Philips, I wonder if anybody knew Ruth Brown was gone. After a sad remake of Mama, He Treats Your Daughter Mean and a few other flops, she retired. But don't look for a sad ending here. Those who knew her always said Ruth was a great actress, and although there weren't a lot of roles for middle-aged black women out there, she eventually got them, both on television and in such movies as Hairspray. Today, she's appearing on Broadway in the show Black and Blue, for which she won a Tony Award last year. And when people hear her sing, they realize that she's just gotten better.
Ruth Brown also hosts the NPR program Blues Stage. Ed Ward is co-author of Rock of Ages, the Rolling Stone history of rock and roll.
And all
say you want me.
This is Fresh Air. Russell Chatham's two necessary passions in life are painting and fishing. In one of his essays about the outdoors, he wrote, "Some of us went quite crazy over fishing at a pretty tender age. I think those like myself were at first seeking a kind of refuge away from the erratic and sometimes frightening behavior of our young peers. For some, fishing was a momentary distraction, soon to be replaced by cars, sports, and a teenager's natural attraction to the opposite sex. For others, change came more slowly and painfully. Some of the results of the latter were an expansion of real knowledge about fishing, development of finely tuned skills, and a more mature understanding of just how reliable the natural world really is, something only sensed earlier." This natural world figures strongly in Russell Chatham's landscape paintings of the West. Chatham is a self-taught painter and writer. An early influence was his grandfather, the painter Gottardo Piazzone, whose murals hang in the San Francisco Public Library. His grandfather first exposed Chatham to oils when he was three. I asked him if he could still recall how he felt when he first saw and smelled the paint.
The thing I remember most was there were some tubes of paint which, in retrospect, of course, were tubes that he was finished with. They were only half full. And one in particular is this really filthy sort of gnarled tube which I opened up. And looking at that yellow paint, which was like what we would call a cadmium yellow, probably medium, and just thinking that the smell of it and the consistency of it and the color of it was simply the most beautiful thing I'd ever seen.
Much of your artwork reflects the landscape of California and of Montana, and you clearly spend a great deal of time out of doors. Is there a special pleasure for you in painting out of doors, the plain air kind of painting, as opposed to being in a studio?
Well, absolutely. Outside. The way I feel about it is what you're doing outside is you're filling the well, collecting information, you're sketching, and you're responding directly to what you see around you. It's a very, needless to say, a very pleasant way to paint, and it's also very important because it keeps the new stimulus that you bring in, keeps you from repeating yourself. When you go into the studio, you're doing a more reflective kind of painting, and in my case at least, working completely from memory, pulling in images, which of course your mind distorts in your own particular way. The two are very different. They have obvious similarities, but they are quite different.
One of your stories describes the changes that you've seen on the Gualala River in Northern California. Going from a time when you were there in your youth, when it was possible for there to be one fisherman per pool, and now it's jammed with people in prams and standing around in the water so that you probably can't get a decent cast in. One of the sort of emotions I sense in your writing is a sense of loss about the outdoor world. And I wonder also if your painting, if your time in the landscape, you also have a sort of sense of loss as the landscape changes around you.
Well, clearly you do. I grew up, lived in San Francisco till I was 10 years old. We moved over to Marin County in 1950. And at that time, Marin County was extremely rural, and it was a place where you could deer hunt. This would be unthinkable today. And we had excellent fishing, terrific salmon and steelhead fishing, duck hunting, quail hunting, all that sort of thing. And I do definitely have a sense of loss because it's impossible for me to return to the places where I used to fish and hunt and which I loved very much because what was there is now vanished.
Do you fear the same thing might happen as a result of people coming to know Montana through your paintings and your writings?
Well, it's inevitable. It won't be as severe, of course, as it was in California, because the climate there is so brutal that it isn't. People are not drawn to the area to live. It's economically depressed and so forth. But what we do see up there is a tremendous increase in fishermen and hunters, vacationers, skiers, and so forth. We're not at a point right now where we're looking at any sort of disaster, but in the short time that I've been there, which is 18 years or thereabouts, there's been quite a drastic change around the area where I live, which is in the southwest corner, about 50 miles north of Yellowstone Park in Livingston on the Yellowstone River. Frankly, that area now resembles the Marin County I grew up in, and it's beginning to feel a little crowded to me.
Hmm. You live near where the Jefferson, the Madison, and the Gallatin Rivers come together at Three Forks to form the Missouri River. I wonder if you could describe that physical setting for us.
Oh, it's quite an extraordinary one, both physically and, of course, historically. I'm, at the moment, working on a large painting using that motif. It's an odd, dry, kind of desert, rocky landscape. And the Jefferson winds in very slowly from the west. The Madison is in its own valley coming down from Yellowstone Park. The Madison tends to flow at a rather even rate the year round. The Gallatin is what you would probably describe. It's the smallest of the three rivers coming in from the east. But right there at Three Forks, you have this kind of braid where they come together, and of course, as they meet and become the Missouri River, it's quite a formidable stream. This painting that I'm working on, which was a commission from the Museum of the Rockies, is a view from the Missouri, from the north side, from the Missouri side, looking back down from a hill there onto the confluence of the rivers, so that we see them, if you could imagine seeing them in two dimensions, would be like looking at tree branches. It's the armature of the painting is the reflection of the sky off of these braids of the rivers as they join.
Your depictions of rivers through your artwork got a mixed reaction from, what was it, somebody at the Whitney Museum who wondered whether, in fact, the river that you had painted was, in fact, the Yellowstone River?
Well, that was a bit comical. I think that the director wanted to see if he could acquire a painting for their collection. And their collection tends to be, I think, directed more at what comes to mind when you say Western art, which is, shall we say, a fairly realistic approach to either the landscape or cowboys, Indians, that sort of thing, whether historical or not. And so I painted several paintings thinking that I would give them a choice of these. And it was simply the first painting they looked at, I think, was they were unaccustomed to seeing paintings that looked different than any others. And evidently someone who was involved with the money end of things on the board or something like that looked at this painting and felt that it was an extremely, extremely vague concoction and made the remark that, well, yes, he says it's the Yellowstone River, but how do we know? And what was doubly funny, of course, to me was that during the time I was painting this picture, in my mind, of course, it was so utterly specific that it never occurred to me that anybody else would think it was vague.
The part of Montana that you live in has become in some ways chic. You're there. The author Thomas McGuane is living in Montana. It attracted Richard Brautigan. The number of Hollywood movie stars are now living in Montana as a retreat or year-round as a base of operations. And part of the notice that you have earned is from attention from Hollywood stars. And I'm wondering how this has affected your sense of yourself as a painter.
Well, not terribly, simply because if you or the listeners could see the area, you would the first thing you would notice is that it's not chic at all. There's no visible evidence of movie stars or what have you. And the people, the authors who came there and movie stars alike live pretty simply. We're not talking about Aspen or Sun Valley or anything like that where there's, shopping for the rich and restaurants and this sort of thing. The area to outward appearances is quite normal, and I think that the point here is that the people who move there, and they're really not so many as one is led to believe, have done so simply to be away from chic, to be someplace quiet where they can enjoy a little anonymity, if you will. And so the way that I live my daily life, I don't see anything chic at all. I'm able to live very, very simply without any interferences whatsoever from the outside.
Well, Russell Chatham, I'd like to thank you very much for coming in and talking with us today on Fresh Air.
Well, thank you.
Landscape painter, writer, and fly fisherman Russell Chatham. Some of his essays and articles are collected in his recent book, Dark Waters, published by Clark City Press in Livingston, Montana. Chatham is Clark City's publisher. This is Fresh Air. Later here on National Public Radio, today's edition of All Things Considered, host Robert Siegel has joined us. Hello, Robert.
Hello, Sedge. Today we'll be hearing about the fighting in the southern Soviet Union that involves Azerbaijanis and Armenians. And, of course, yesterday Soviet President Gorbachev said he was sending troops down to the area to try to police matters. Also, news of pollution of the Calumet River in Indiana. Former Surgeon General C. Everett Koop's thoughts about drug testing in the workplace. He's a part of a group that supports establishing minimal federal standards for what drug testing is. And Bob Mondello's a review of the new French film with Isabella Gianni.
Thanks for the preview, Robert. All this and All Things Considered later here on National Public Radio. Book critic John Leonard has been reading some new mysteries from both sides of the Atlantic and has a review of two of them, The Good Fight by Leah Matera and Devices and Desires by P.D. James.
Knee-deep in the new P.D. James, I was tired of her world-weary poet-detective, Dogleash, and tired of her remote Norfolk headland with its windmill and its nuclear power station, and tired in advance of the thought of describing her new British mystery, Devices and Desires, because any synopsis will make it sound better than it really is, and I'd be duty-bound to commend her for taking the chances she does, wrapping up the case of the serial killer halfway through the book, and then going on to explain an altogether unrelated murder involving unlikely artists and impossible terrorists. When the real problem with the last three P.D. James mysteries is that somebody told her she was an important novelist, and she's going on at enormous length, putting on grand airs, opinionizing promiscuously, without the necessary stylistic resources or the intellectual wherewithal. If you want to read an interesting novel about nuclear power stations, at least three Germans have already written one each, Günter Grass, Heinrich Böll, and Christa Wolf. This is to explain why I seized on the new Leah Matera. Matera went to law school out in Berkeley, California, and also taught at Stanford Law before she started writing mysteries. In her first two, A Radical Departure and Where Lawyers Fear to Tread, we met a young woman, Willa Jansen, more interesting than Dalgleish will ever be, with a mother who was more troubled than Philip Roth's Sophie Portnoy. Willa's mother was a communist, whereas Willa was merely a 60s liberal with a guilty conscience. Willa's mother didn't care how many eggs she broke to make the omelet of her revolution, whereas Willa fell in love with the macho cop who accused her of murder. A Radical Departure and Where Lawyers Fear to Tread, both available in paperback, are witty takes on the radical politics scene in the Bay Area, and I'm in love with Willa. Willa, unfortunately, doesn't show up in The Good Fight, Matera's latest. Instead, we get Laura, Laura De Palma, a somewhat older woman lawyer, albeit with a left-wing past, but without the pinko mother. Laura used to fight the good fight against the armed goons of the oppressor, but now, at an old shoe conservative law firm, she makes money, buys things, and feels bad, until one of her pro bono guilty conscience clients rings her radical chimes. Dan Crescetti is in a wheelchair because the government ran over his legs when he was trying to stop a troop train. He's accused of murdering an undercover FBI agent, although his whole life and his missing legs have been dedicated to nonviolence. Laura risks her chances at a partnership to defend him, not only because she believes in his innocence, but also because she's got something to prove to her boyfriend, an embittered Vietnam vet. She has an ex-boyfriend, too, who's an ex-cop with his own theories about nonviolence. And after many stops at the station of the Double Cross, we arrive at a brand new definition of the chivalric code. But meanwhile, there's a murder to solve, not to mention nuclear waste, that moves in the night in our dreams. Sharply written, brilliantly observed, and not the least bit presumptuous, The Good Fight is a good read. I still miss Willa, who was funnier.
John Leonard writes about television for New York Magazine as a columnist for New York Newsday and as media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. He reviewed The Good Fight by Leah Matera and Devices and Desires by P.D. James. Our reviews and commentaries are produced by Naomi Person with assistance from Joan Tuohy and Roberta Shorrock. Joyce Lieberman is our technical director. I'm Sej Thompson.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, psychiatrist Robert J. Lifton looks back at his 1961 book on Chinese brainwashing in light of recent events in China and Eastern Europe and the rise of religious cults. And anthropologist Sally Price tells why art from other cultures that doesn't make the Western sieve art history books gets labeled as primitive. That and more next time on Fresh Air.